Hello and welcome to another episode of A Law in Common, India and the United States, a podcast brought to you by the India Center for Law and Justice at Seattle University. I'm your host, Bhavya Kandala. I am a licensed attorney in India with an LLM in technology laws from Seattle University and currently preparing for the state bar examination. Today's episode is on how patent laws impact trade relations between India and the United States. And to take us through this, we have our guest, Professor Srividya Raghavan, Professor of Law and Director of India Programs at Texas A&M University School of Law. She is the author of the book, Patent and Trade Disparities in Developing Countries. She testified before the International Trade Commission on a hearing involving the question of trade, investment, and industrial policies in India, and also testified before the Office of the United States Trade Representative, USTR, on a special 301 hearing on India's intellectual property law in 2014. Thank you so much for coming on, Professor.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
We will begin this discussion by addressing if different approaches to patent law systems by India and United States affect their trade relations. Then we'll go to examine the reasons for US's persistent interest in Indian patent law system. Later, learn what the USTR, or the United States Trade Representative, is all about, its special 301 report, and the lens through which USTR perceives trade laws of its trading partners. Then we will delve into reasons behind USTR's special 301 report identifying India as one of the world's most challenging major economies with respect to patent law concerns and how these patent law concerns impact India and US's trade relations. So, let's get started with some background questions around patents to get us and all the listeners onto the same page before we begin the discussion.
Absolutely.
Professor, could you please tell us what is patent protection? Why is it historically important for a nation to have a tailored body of IP laws addressing their domestic, international, social, economic, and cultural needs?
Thank you. So patents is one of the several streams of intellectual property protection. Patents is distinguished in that it is the only typology of intellectual property rights that actually protects the underlying idea behind the protection. Now, in order to get patent protection, the underlying idea should be useful, novel, and non-obvious. Now, patents is also distinguished in the sense that this is the only area of intellectual property rights which goes through an examination system, as opposed to, say, copyrights or trademarks, which undergoes a registration process. The patent office examines the application to determine whether it's capable of qualifying for patent protection. Historically, patents can be used as a very effective tool, and it has been used as a very effective tool for promoting innovation. And because of that, several Western countries, I mean, the US included, but also UK, Germany, and other countries have used patent law as a specific tool to promote innovation, and in turn to cater to larger public socioeconomic goals. And therefore, I think it's absolutely important for every country to have a patent system that is, that promotes innovation, but in a manner addressing the local socioeconomic, cultural sort of conditions.
So at the first glance of Indian and US patent laws, in a comparative perspective, one can find that there is a difference in the way the law is stated. Consider the definition of patent, for example. US takes a more illustrative approach where it states what can be patented, while India's patent laws, on the other hand, say what cannot be patented. So my question here is, irrespective of this difference in approach or implementation, do these laws aim to cover the same patentable subject matter?
So the difference in legislation as such, where Section 3 in India, for example, starts with what cannot be patented, whereas if you take Title 35, it begins with what are the components for patent protection. Those are attributable to legislative drafting, different styles of legislative drafting. But if you take that apart, the substance of this, right, both are strongly sort of grounded in the common law system. So they're very similar in that sense. Their approach is very similar too in that sense. Both countries, both the India and the United States, are members of the World Trade Organization and of the TRIPS Agreement. So the World Trade Organization is the, you know, is the organization that governs world trade through various agreements. And the TRIPS Agreement is the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Agreement, which all of these countries have signed to, right? So because they're all signatories of the TRIPS Agreement, all of these member countries, of which India is one and the US is another, they all have harmonized minimum standards of IP protection. And that includes for patents as well. So if you see, the approach may be different, but much of the, you know, what is patentable, what are the criteria for protection, all of this is very similar and comparable between these two jurisdictions.
So irrespective of what words are used to communicate, the objective that both these law, sets of laws communicate is the same, and they cover similar subject matter.
Absolutely right. They cover similar subject matter, similar requirements and eligibility requirements for protection, similar words too, but the approach is different coming from different legislative drafting styles. So the same things like utility, novelty, non-obviousness, we call it distinctiveness. So there may be a small semantic difference there, but otherwise they're all very sort of similar in both jurisdictions.
So this brings me to another question, which is, does this difference in approach in patent laws affect the trade relations between the two countries? If yes, to what extent?
So the differences in approach does affect trade relations. But the type of approach that actually affects trade relations are those that are catered towards domestic needs. Right. So the minimum standards cater to the global, international global minimum standards that all member countries have to institute. But within that, the TRIPS agreement allows for each country to establish certain levels of flexibilities. Right. And that will depend on the socioeconomic stature of the country, the development, and so on and so forth. And that tends to create, you know, trade frictions between, you know, these two nations. Now, particularly taking the United States as an example, US looks at that prevails in the rest of the trading world, right? In it, with in its trading partners, keen sense of what is good for the United States. So that's the lens with which we look at trade laws in other countries. And so anything that may be good for, say, India or any other country that may not be good for US industries tend to cause trade tensions, which is what we see in the case of India as well.
That specific observation brings me to my next question, which is US's interest in India's patent laws. So India has become an important trading partner for the United States over the past three decades. Both countries are signatories of international treaties, like you suggested, relating to IP and trade, namely the TRIPS, the Patent Cooperation Treaty, or the Paris Convention. But the relationship has been marred by longstanding disagreements on everything from dairy products to pharmaceuticals to other IP rights. So on looking back, we can observe that intellectual property rights in India have been a chief US concern since about 1989. This was the year the first Special 301 report mandated by the Congress was issued. So before we move in, could you please throw some light on what the Special 301 report is, What's its significance and who releases it?
The Special 301 report, as we call it, right, is authorized, I want to say, right, by the U.S. Trade Act. The U.S. Trade Act authorizes the USTR, the Office of the United States Trade Representative, under Section 184, to compile a report for Congress. That's part of USTR's obligations to, it's part of congressional oversight over the USTR office, right? So the USTR compiles the Special 301 report, essentially by getting information from U.S. industries to highlight the trade laws that prevails in its trading partners, and if any of these trade laws poses trade barriers to U.S. trade interests in those countries. So I want to make that very clear. The whole role of USTR, right, it's first of all an administrative body. It looks at other sovereign nations and makes a list of, list of trade and intellectual property barriers that it perceives as barriers, not as such, not general barriers, but barriers to U.S. industries, right? Trading in that country from the perspective of the U.S. industries. It's a unilateral measure. When this was originally started, it had two purposes. One is to essentially use the higher bargaining parity that the U.S. had, especially in bilateral or, regional sort of engagements or multilateral engagements, which was not within the WTO at that time, right? So to use that and to basically kind of highlight the, the trade muscle of the U.S., so to speak. The second biggest objective was to push some of these countries into a multilateral trading framework. So instead of doing bilateral sort of one-on-one negotiations, the Western countries, most of them EU, US, Japan, all of these countries wanted a more multilateral approach. And that's how the Special 301 report started. The Special 301 report, if you look at it, it categorizes countries into three separate typologies: the priority foreign countries, priority watch list, and the watch list. So I don't know if you want me to explain these things now, but I can tell you some of the questions that we get, the long-standing relations trade issues, such as dairy products or intellectual property rights and so on, is because of two main trade issues, right? One of which is health-related. Because health is very closely related to democracy, right to speech, right to life, so on and so forth. These are, in India, we call it fundamental rights, right? So health in several countries is very closely related to fundamental rights to life. Brazil is an example. India is an example. And there are other countries too, because it's also closely related to development and, GDP of the country and so on and so forth. The other big question relates to agriculture, because that relates to right to food, right? So when the WTO agreement was negotiated, patent protection was considered, or at least the Western countries pushed for intellectual property protection, especially patents in pharmaceuticals, right? So that it opens up the global market for Western pharmaceuticals, right? However, at that time, most countries agreed to push back the agricultural negotiations, which hasn't happened even now. So there is a lot of disparities in subsidies and agricultural subsidies framework, right? Which would benefit the poorer countries, such as India. India is one country that will benefit, but certainly Africa and other countries would benefit much more, from an agricultural negotiation that's more equitable, which we haven't seen happen since the time the WTO has been signed, right? And because of that, you see that the trade tensions have prevailed in these two big areas, and that's prevailed over a period of time. So that's my long answer to the question. Sorry if I took too much time.
Not at all, Professor. Now that we learn the USTR releases this special 301 report unilaterally and that the data it relies on is primarily from the US-based industries, let's turn to its special 301 report and examine why India was always one of the countries placed on its priority watch list, irrespective of India's progress over the decades, amendments to patent laws, and ensuring compliance with WTO's TRIPS agreement. So, Professor, could you please elaborate on what these priority watch lists are and reasons for US's persistent interest in Indian patent law system?
Sure. And that's a very, very good question and an interesting question as well. So when we talked about the special 301 report, we said countries are categorized in three bands, right? So one is, I've written about this, and the Hindu and the Hindu Business Line has extensively published on these three things, right? So the priority foreign countries are the countries, it's like the US telling, US has a list and US has an eye on these lists, right? So US watches these countries very closely, and they believe that these countries are derogating from some of the trade agreements. The priority watch list is, so let me put it this way, right? The priority foreign countries are countries that the US is saying, I'm stalking you. I'm watching you 24/7, I'm stalking you, right? Priority watch list is, I am going to stalk you because I'm watching you, right? I mean, I'm closely monitoring the situation there, right? Whereas the watch list is, well, you're interesting. I think you're doing something wrong here, right? But, you know, I'm well muscled. That's what the US is saying. So you be careful. It's more like a warning list, right? Now, when we signed the WTO agreement, so this is a sidebar that I want to highlight. Most countries moved into the multilateral framework. The multilateral framework basically necessitated all members, including the United States, to go with the dispute settlement process of the WTO. So basically, the era of flexing individual muscles through unilateral trade sanctions should have been over at that time, right? But US is the most muscled person in that room, so nobody would say, well, will you sit down? But, you know, because everybody's vying for trade, right? So nobody said it. Nevertheless, a bunch of countries actually went and sought a panel as well as an appellate body, because appeal to the appellate body, a WTO decision, the decision titled Special 301 to 309 of the Trade Act. So that's the name of the case, which the WTO's dispute settlement body addressed. In that, the DSB said that US cannot impose unilateral sanctions, nor can they threaten other countries. So after that, the number of countries that are in the priority foreign country list has either gone down or not, has been non-existent, because that would be a clear violation of the WTO, and so the US does not do it. Right. But and so many of these countries tend to feature in the priority watch list. Right. So Michael Palmedo of American University and I, we did a study. And this was something that Palmedo had basically collected the data, and he and we published it. About 56% of the world's population live in countries that have been on the priority watch list of the Special 301 report, right? So which means most of the countries in the world have been categorized under, you know, the priority watch list. Part of the reason is because American industries want these countries as their global markets, right? So anytime they see any sort of loss that affects their, you know, they're getting that market, obviously that country starts featuring in the priority watch list of the WTO. So I don't know if I've answered all of your question. And why is India persistent in that, in the priority watch list? India is persistent, obviously, because we are a developing market. You know, we are a younger market compared to, say, some of the other countries. And India has a, you know, a growing middle class capable of spending. and India is developing, especially in pharmaceuticals. I mean, what are the two options? India is knocking the door on becoming the next big innovator, right? So do you want them to be a competitor, or do you want to try and flex your muscles? I think for US, strategically, it makes more sense to flex its muscles, right? So obviously India is in the, you know, it only shows that India is becoming more and more powerful in terms of its innovation, and it's knocking on the door to get to the next level of innovation cycle.
Wonderful. From the report itself, I have few concerns identified, and we can go through each of them and get your input as to why that could have been the concern. So firstly, the report states that the potential threat of patent revocations, lack of presumption of patent validity, and the narrow patentability criteria under the Indian Patents Act impacts companies across different sectors. Why would this be identified as a concern by the US?
So from the time that the US started the Special 301 reports, if you actually see some of the submissions of companies, companies like IBM, other technology companies, they have not had any problems with any of these issues, right? I mean, you will actually see IBM. There are submissions from IBMs and, Amazon has an office in India. Microsoft has an office in India. They recruit heavily from India. So they don't, they don't have the type of concerns where they say any of this is a problem. The specific concerns of each of these things, patent revocations, lack of presumption of patent validity, narrow patentability criteria. I want to take all three of these individually. That comes from the pharmaceutical sector, right? Part of the reason is if you take the United States, patents don't get revoked. Instead, we look at patents, and this has been one of the criticisms of the Federal Circuit too. We are more sort of inventor friendly, and we like to keep these inventions privileged for as long as we can, right? Now that's coming back to bite the United States in the healthcare sector. If from the perspective of the Inflation Reduction Act, President Biden's 2022 Inflation Reduction Act, one of the most important healthcare related charges is for the USPTO and the USFDA to sort of work with each other. That's one of the things that they've advertised for in the Federal Register, to find opportunities to work with each other such that some of the manipulations of the patent system that's being done by pharmaceutical companies, which actually acts as a barrier for consumers to access pharmaceutical products, come down, right? So if you take India as an example, because we have narrow patent pre as well as post grant patent revocations, the patents that are in fact granted in India are high quality patents. Unlike in the US, where, many of the patents can be invalidated, right? Well, in India too, it can be invalidated, but many of the patents that are invalidated have, let me rephrase it, have questionable non-obviousness criteria. Right. Whereas in India, things like Section 3D acts as gatekeepers. It prevents some of these, minor inventions from getting patented. It prevents the formation of what in this country, in the US, we call as patent thickets. And we see these patent thickets acting as a barrier to pharmaceutical products entering the market for both types of drugs, like generic as well as biosimilars. And the time it takes to, the time as well as the cost, I want to add, it takes to litigate a questionable patent is much higher than going through the administrative process and then revoking some patents that does not work well, right? So I think India's system works for the type of socioeconomic conditions that prevails there. It does not derogate from TRIPS. And therefore, I think, it may be difficult for companies in the US, especially pharmaceutical sector that's used to lobbying, the politicians here and then strong arming them into getting the kind of laws that they want to get the same type of treatment in India. But as far as India is concerned, it's definitely not a bad system for India's domestic needs. Similarly, the pre-grant opposition, which is a cause for concern in the US, right? It conserves both administrative time and then the litigation costs for the opposers, so to speak, right? So because it conserves that, it actually works very well to limit the number of patents, which means more sort of quality patents are issued. Same with Section 3D. There was a study by WIPO that clearly looked at some of these things, and it said that under Article 62.4, I think, of the TRIPS Agreement, none of these things are a derogation of the TRIPS Agreement. You know, the pre-grant opposition and the higher threshold, these are all not derogations of the TRIPS Agreement. So I think India is well, you know, it's poised to be in the right place.
Right. So I can understand it's a little easier to showcase that the patent is non-obvious in the US than in India, which is what triggered. And that is the reason why this is identified as a concern in this particular report, right?
Absolutely.
Moving on to the second one, the report identifies that patent applications continue to confront costly and time-consuming pre- and post-grant oppositions, long waiting periods to receive patent grants, and excessive reporting requirements. How adversely does this costly and time-consuming process affect the international trade in patent right holders? We've partially addressed this concern of high costs and time-consuming litigation, while I still want you to address how this affects the international trade in patent right holders.
So let's look at patent right holders. Does it affect them? It absolutely affects them because they cannot get the same things that they're able to get in the United States and some of these countries, right? So how does it affect international trade? So I want to take the US as an example to explain why this is a problem, right? If you take some of the blockbuster drugs in the US, Humira, for example, it has generated billions with a B, B for boy, right? So we are talking about billions in profits, right? Benefited from one study, at least, about 311 patent applications, out of which 165 patents actually issued for that one drug, right? And because of the several patents that covers Humira, the number of years of protection that this drug actually enjoyed in the market is about 43.5 years or something like that. And these have generated billions of dollars in profits. And Humira is no sole example. There are other examples as well, both in the generic as well as in the biosimilar industry. Other cancer drugs and Humira, when there was a dispute of patent invalidity, right? So when a biosimilar company wanted to enter that same market, and when they challenged a Humira patent, right? Humira asserted 75 patents against that biosimilar company. Right. I want to highlight one more thing. If you are a patent holder for a drug like Humira or a cancer drug, you're going to sell it at, I don't know, $100,000 a pop. Right. Now, once you sell these drugs, you have profits accumulated. Whereas a biosimilar that wants to enter the market comes with no money from the market. So they're already in a negative financial position. And then they have to go through these costly litigations to invalidate the existing patents. So you're right that this system that India has would adversely affect patent right holders, but it will benefit competition. It will benefit healthcare. It will benefit consumers, which is the ultimate objective of the patent system. I'm not against patent rights, but I'm against the egregious violations that you see or the manipulation of the system at the cost of access to meds, right? Okay, I'm not against egregious patent rights, but I'm against, you know, manipulating the system, right, in a way that it affects access to medication. And that becomes the biggest problem in this.
Yes, that is very right. The report identifies India maintains high customs duties direct to IP-intensive products such as medical devices, pharmaceuticals, information and communication technology products, solar energy equipment, and capital goods. Could you please elaborate this statement with examples from pharmaceutical industry specifically? And why does the US identify high customs duties as a priority issue?
So let me start from the US vantage because it's easier to understand. So when during the pandemic, when President Trump had to deal with issues, we increased the steel, the customs duty for steel by about 25%. Right? It shut out many of the European steel imports. The entire idea was to help local steel production. So if you look specifically at high customs duties, it's a protectionist measure. It does not comport with the spirit of the WTO. Nevertheless, almost every member does that when there is a domestic issue, when there is a domestic supply-demand problem, or when they want to support their local industries or domestic industries, at that time, usually customs duties become high. Now, President Biden has not reversed the steel tariffs. Those customs duties have been left as such because we want to help the steel lobby, so to speak, right? We have about 150 steel workers and we want to be able to help them. And so even though the consumers are close to about, I think, 7 million or 6 million, we still want to protect the local steel industry. And so, you know, customs duties have been high. With reference to India's pharmaceutical industry, especially with medical devices, right? India is at a point where there are local companies that are getting ready to make these medical devices and so on. So India is at a place where it does want to promote some of those local innovations and some of those local devices and techniques, right? And because of that, you do see that there is a slightly high custom duty. Same with solar energy. India is way ahead. Of course, there has been a solar energy dispute. India lost the dispute because, you know, it was very clear that India was protecting its local innovation. And so it lost the dispute. So to that extent, yes. But there is a reason why these are done. And these things are done to promote local industries. And that's the reason India is doing this. And of course, this means that they have to enter into negotiations and then decide what is best for them. There's only one thing I want to highlight here, and that is with reference to local innovation and local manufacturing. I don't know if in the US people have been following the diabetes debate. Insulin, which is priced at $6 a vial in India, $38 a vial in Canada, was sold at $350 a vial until last month by Eli Lilly, right? Part of the reason was because the original patent for insulin issued in 1923, right? And yet, Eli Lilly was able to hold on to one or the other version of an improvement for the drug, and that's how prices continued to be very high. When the insulin crisis, when the insulin issue became a crisis in the United States, what we saw that was California wanted to locally manufacture insulin. It did not want to buy generics from India. It wanted to locally produce insulin. Now, that's exactly what India wants to do with its pharmaceutical generics. It wants to locally produce. And we have, you know, the United States has filed, and it is basically called that a derogation of WTO disputes and so on, right? I mean, WTO agreements and so on, right? But it's comparable. It's not exactly the same for various reasons. It's only comparable at some points. But local manufacturing and local production is the first step to innovation. So, and that's exactly what India is trying to do. It's trying to get to the next stage of innovation by doing, you know, through these high customs duties and so on.
That makes great sense, as India is trying to justify its high custom duties because it wants to promote local innovation and go to the next step. US, on the other side, is experiencing high custom duties to reach the customers. And lastly, this report also identifies that stakeholders also continue to raise concerns as to whether India has an effective system for protecting against unfair commercial use and unauthorized disclosure of undisclosed data or other data generated to obtain marketing approval for pharmaceuticals and agricultural chemical products. What reasons can be attributed for this particular concern?
This particular concern arises out of the not mandatory requirement in Article 39.3 of the TRIPS Agreement. 39.3 basically states that countries can protect data, and these are called as data exclusivities, and they run parallelly with patent exclusivities, right? So just so, you know, listeners are clear about this, when I get a patent on a drug, I get 20 years of monopoly protection. That does not allow me to take that drug and put it in the market. I still have to go through the FDA process to make sure that it's safe for people or animals, as the case is. Now, when I take it to the FDA, FDA basically wants clinical studies to prove that this is, in fact, safe for human or animal consumption, as the case is. Now, those clinical study data, which says Asian population get a headache, whereas Caucasian population gets stomachache from taking, say, Tylenol, right? Those are protected as data because, you know, there's no innovation there. That's just data. And that data, I mean, data takes a different form for software and other things, but I'm focusing on pharmaceutical data protection, right? So data protection, we call it as regulatory exclusivities or data exclusivities. They take different forms in the US. In the US, new drugs basically get the data on new drugs, new drug approvals get 5 years of exclusivities. New chemical applications get 4 years of data exclusivities. So basically, today I apply for Tylenol, and then I prove that it's safe, I get 5 years. Tomorrow, I mix half a Tylenol with half ibuprofen, and then I come with this new drug that takes care of stomachache and headache. It's a new chemical combination. I can apply for separate protection for it and then get another 4 years. And if I'm smart and I do that in my 18th year of patent protection, right, then I can get my patents maybe over, but my clinical data, which will prevent generic drug industries from getting another, from marketing their product, will protect that particular drug for another 2 years, right? And if it's a biosimilar, US provides 12 years. US is the only jurisdiction in the world that provides 12 years of data protection for biologic information, right? So a biosimilar cannot be approved for 12 years from the time of approval of the biologic by the FDA. Obviously, the US likes it, right? But there are issues with this. What are the concerns here? This alone is the major reason why the US does not have biosimilars. In the globe today, right? Even China has more biosimilars and generics to help consumers access medication than the US. All of the other countries allow for generics or biosimilars to enter the market as soon as patent protection is over because they allow for quick approvals. But in the US, this can be delayed such that biosimilars cannot enter the market. Now, because of this, there is a study by, I think, Rachel Goody and one other person. That study basically shows that the number of patents asserted against a biosimilar is much higher in the US than in Europe or in any other part of the globe, right? So these are some of the issues that comes by providing extreme data or regulatory protection, which we hope now that the new Federal Register requirement will, well, you know, it's also called as patent linkage. In India, the Roche v. Bolar dispute. Basically, the Delhi High Court dispute basically said that we do not provide for patent linkage. US wants that type of patent linkage. Hopefully, we won't get into that system.
So basically, the industry holders, the entrepreneurs and the patent right holders here in the US would expect such kind of warranties from other countries, and they're not getting it. They just identify it and push it onto the report as a priority issue to be dealt with.
Absolutely.
While there might not be anything wrong with the way India is dealing with this, recently, India and the United States have been working closely to further their future trade relations. In view of advancing these goals, they held the 12th ministerial level meeting of India-United States Trade Policy Reform, TPF, on the 23rd of November 2021. Alongside USPTO and India's Department for Promotion of Industry and Internal Trade, DPIIT, signed a new MOU in December 2020 related to IP technical cooperation mechanisms and are in process of entering into a binding work plan to guide the implementation of this memorandum. Can you please explain if the current approach by both these countries to resolve any of these issues identified in the report that we discussed today is right? Or should these issues be approached any differently? If yes, then should these issues even be addressed or resolved? Or do they even need any resolution?
So the approach by the United States, I think, is perfect because they involve academics. They involve the industry and they seek bilateral negotiations, knowing that they clearly have the strength and the bargaining parity in these negotiations. I mean, if you are the US, you are the most more muscled of the two. And on top of it, you have the industry, the academics, and so on and so forth to back you up, right? India has great policies, but I think of late, India does not engage its academics as well as it needs to. You know, there are experts in this area that India, and I said this of the Indian national IP policy as well, right? I mean, in the US, a national IP policy would have largely consisted of robust academic discussion. In India, it did not have that at all. I want to say that's a flaw in India's approach, right? And I also see that when it comes to these more sort of technical areas, as much as people have expertise, it's better to have a more sort of robust discussion and research on these issues to appreciate how this will have long-term impact. That, I think, from India's side needs to be addressed. I think India is in a position where it can assert itself, and it can assert itself very well if it can actually use the strength of people who have the knowledge on the subject and use it well. I almost see that there is a hesitation on India's part to do that. But if you ask me about the US, I think it has a perfect strategy and it's able to prevail on India in some of these things. India can change a bit of its strategy going forward, I think.
So surveying and valuing the opinion of not just politicians, but also people who are engaged in the activity and also academics to chip in their opinion about how this could play out would allow them to make an informed decision about how this needs to be addressed or resolved in the first place.
Absolutely. Because see, industries have a vested interest. Politicians have an interest to cater to the electorate, right? It's only academics who can have, you know, first of all, that type of time to devote for deep knowledge and the impartial approach to some of these issues, right? So I think it's important to involve all stakeholders, which the US does effectively. So I don't see why India cannot.
Unfortunately, we must conclude this enriching discussion as we are running over time. Thank you so much for taking the time to provide this invaluable information to our listeners, Professor. To sum it all up, today we discussed all about patent systems of India and US, the United States Trade Representative, USTR, and why USTR identified India as one of the most challenging major economies with respect to patent law concerns, and how these patent law concerns impact India and US trade relations. We examined the lens through which USTR perceives US's trading partners and learned that though the Special 301 report identified various patent law concerns with India, since India's patent laws are fully compliant with TRIPS, India is in a position to be able to assert itself and is marching in the right direction by addressing its domestic, social, and economic needs. Also, that India's patent laws may adversely affect the patent right holders in the US, but will ultimately benefit the competition, benefit healthcare, and benefit consumers, which is the ultimate objective of the patent systems. In addition, we learned that when it comes to legislating technical areas like patents, just like the US, India can also benefit by having robust discussions and research by involving all stakeholders to promote innovation and also analyze the long-term impact of any rule or regulation. I have personally learned a lot in this discussion. You know, the perspectives I had not thought of, and certainly this discussion will help our listeners understand the dynamics of trade relations between India and US through the lens of patent laws. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for the invitation. I very much enjoyed doing this, and thanks for your patience with me.
Professor, could you also please share with our listeners where they could access or read your work?
All of my writings, books, etc. can be found in sriraghavan.com, www.sriraghavan.com. If you can, if your listeners can go there, they can download papers and articles and so on from there, and then they can take it from there.
Once again, thank you very much for your time, Professor.
No, I'm glad to hear that.